old enough to understand its absence from my life. I found peace. As elusive as it had seemed, it had been where it had always been, concealed behind a door of forgiveness. I looked again at the name on the grave, and I was certain of what forgiveness required of me. To set aside the known shackles of the past for the untested wings of the future, I was to protect and honor my father's name. Chapter 25. The Plea.
It is my observation that too often this world builds monuments to those it stoned in the flesh.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. The office fell quiet, and Amanda, poised over an earthen cup of hot coffee, stared at me in stunned bewilderment, as if she had misunderstood.
No plea bargain?
No. She sat back in her chair, studying me.
Do I need to remind you of the seriousness of these charges?
I shook my head. I know things don't look good for me. I won't pretend that I'm not afraid, but I can't do it. I can't convict myself of this crime, even if it means going to prison for my innocence. She leaned back in her chair.
A judge will likely interpret your attitude as lack of remorse.
I can't do it, Amanda, I said softly. I can't forsake my name. It is all that I have left. She stapled her hands under her chin.
When did you decide this?
Last night, at my mother's grave. She sighed.
How I admire your courage, Michael. Unfortunately, most of my heroes are martyrs.
I have no desire to join either rank. I just have to do what I have to do.
Where now?
I asked.
I'll call the prosecution and tell them we're going to trial.
She stood up.
Then you and I have a lot of work ahead of us.
Amanda Epperson was a transplant from Woodstock, Illinois, a picturesque suburb of Chicago that is sometimes used by film producers for feature backdrops. She had met her husband, Phil, while completing her undergraduate degree at Northwestern University, and he dutifully followed her to the University of Utah Law School, where he worked as a driver for UPS and wore a brown uniform. Amanda was already pregnant when she passed the bar and was expecting a girl in mid-May. In the games our minds devised to torture ourselves, I conceived that according to a jury's whim, I would see Amanda's child, either as an infant, or likely not until she was a teenager. Amanda wore hiking boots whenever possible, drove a Jeep Wrangler with a detachable tan canvas top and a bumper sticker that read, "When the sun's out, I go topless." She loved the outdoors, vacationed each year in Zion National Park, and I suspect that she came to Utah as much for the mountains as the quality of the law program. In the months leading up to my trial, I met with Amanda 3 or 4 times each week to work on my case. She was bigger and, I imagine, more uncomfortable each time I saw her. I became accustomed to her radical cravings, and perhaps my greatest contribution to the case, outside of my recollection of my visit to the Veterans Hospital with Henri, was my discovery of the best after-hours outlets for a pint of Snell Grove's burnt almond fudge ice cream, or yogurt-covered pretzels. Out of financial desperation, I took a day job as a convenience store clerk on the north side of Ogden, and in deference to both of our schedules, Amanda and I usually met after work, oftentimes after Phil had gone to bed. It became obvious to me that my case had become a personal crusade for Amanda, and I was sure this was due, in no small part, to her becoming convinced of my innocence. Such things are not supposed to affect a legal defender, but only an automaton could be that detached. Such creative causes must be dictated by passion, and without passion we are doomed to mediocrity. We can't help it. We're just wired that way. I was fortunate that Phil was about as tolerant as a husband could be, and more than once he brought home Chinese or Italian for the three of us as we reviewed testimony in their apartment. I confess that there were times I found it difficult watching such a loving couple in light of Faye's absence. I learned later that he did ask her once if she was becoming too emotionally involved with me, and she kissed him and said no, and he left it at that. He is a good man, and I'm convinced he will be a good father to their child. The weeks passed in a succession of highs and lows, a countdown to perhaps a much larger one. It was probably not unlike the emotional swings of a political candidate as election day nears. Except I was hoping not to serve any term. For better or worse, the anxiousness of the cause had the anesthetic effect of pushing my other concerns to the more shadowed corners of my mind, and there were days that I nearly forgot the two women who had all but consumed it the months before. The night before my trial, one of them called. Chapter 26. The Trial.
There are times that I have been tempted to protect my heart from further disappointment with cynicism. But it would be like poisoning oneself to avoid being murdered.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. The restraining order provided a two-way mirror of sorts, enabling Esther to look into my life while I could not look back at hers. I had not spoken with Esther in quite some time, and I did not recognize her voice at first. It had changed, fallen even more slow and tired than when last we spoke. It worried me.
"Michael?
Is that you, Esther?
Do you go to the court tomorrow?"
"Tomorrow morning."
"I won't be able to come,"
she said sorrowfully.
"How are you feeling?"
She did not answer my question.
"Did Fay come?"
I did not want to answer, more for her than myself.
"No."
There was a pause of considerable duration, and I could hear her irregular breathing.
"I never told you how proud I am of you for standing up to this. Ah, courageous."
"You were right, Esther. I just hope fate is kind."
"You are a good boy. God will be merciful."
"I hope you're right. Thank you, Esther."
Her voice began to falter.
"Come see me when it's over."
"I will, if I can."
She hung up the phone, and I wondered if I would ever see her again. Amanda arrived at my house a full hour before the trial, as I was just finishing getting dressed. The night before, I had asked her how I should dress for the day. "Guileless as a Sunday school altar boy," she replied. I wore taupe slacks with a white long-sleeved Oxford shirt, a necktie, and a tweed jacket that I had borrowed from Phil. Amanda and I had been up late the night before, reviewing testimony and rehearsing likely questions the prosecutor would pose to the witnesses, and what those answers might be. I suspect she did this more for my sake than hers, as I would have gone crazy without her company. She expected the trial to last for 2 or 3 days. I climbed into her Jeep.
"How'd you sleep?"
she asked.
"Very little."
"I expected as much."
"And you?"
She smiled.
"I can sleep through anything, even this baby."
She glanced over at me.
"I had a thought last night. I think the prosecution will call you to the stand."
"I thought you said that they couldn't."
"I said that you don't have to testify against yourself, but in a trial as emotionally charged as this one, they might call you up as an adverse witness, expecting you to plead the Fifth. To the jury, it will look like you're hiding something."
"What do I do?"
"I think you should testify. You'll do all right. In any case, it will likely do less harm than refusing to take the stand."
She grinned and set her hand on my knee.
"Don't worry about it. They may not call you up. It's just a hunch. I want you to remember, no matter what happens today, to stay calm. This is just the first day, and it's the prosecution's show. It's almost all going to be negative. There's nothing the prosecution would like better than to fluster you into looking guilty at the get-go."
She spoke seriously, but with a confidence I had not previously detected. Her trial face, perhaps, but a mask of confidence all the same, and it set me at peace. She took my hand.
I think we have a strong case. Believe in that.
Her optimism did not prepare me for what we were to encounter as we arrived downtown. The hedged walk and grounds surrounding the courthouse were rife with humanity, teeming with newspaper, television, and radio reporters, senior citizens, advocacy groups for the elderly, and just people who needed someone to hate. A small girl held out a handwritten placard that read simply, Leviticus 20, verse 9. I wondered what the scripture said. Like most of my peers, I had arrogantly supposed that I belonged to a more civilized generation than our fathers, but what I saw that day changed my paradigm. Yesterday's lynch mobs are alive and well, in spirit if not in action, fed from the same trough of prejudicial indignation. Amanda held my arm as she hurried me past the throng, as if she were embarrassed for the gathering, and hoped I hadn't noticed it. I had never before been in trouble with the law or set foot in its courts, so my expectations were culled from years of Saturday matinees starring Gregory Peck or Spencer Tracy, and a steady diet of Perry Mason reruns. The courtroom was larger than I had anticipated, though still not large enough to accommodate the incensed public that thronged my gallows. The room was high-ceilinged and elliptically shaped and brightly lit, with hanging deco-glass light fixtures. The room's benches were highly varnished yellow oak, as were the jury box, the court reporter's well, the judge's bench, and the ledges that connected them. The judge's chair was flanked by a large navy blue flag, bearing the beehive insignia of the state of Utah. I counted more than a dozen journalists in the room, scribbling on the long, narrow pads of reporters. Every seat in the gallery was taken, and the back of the room was lined shoulder to shoulder with the standing, leaning against the paneled oak wall. Alice sat behind the bar, near the prosecution's desk. Next to her sat a large, well-dressed man whom I recognized as her father, Starley Richards. I had seen Richards on the 6 o'clock news, talking to reporters about my impending trial, his voice and gesticulation rising in swells of righteous indignation for the waywardness of today's youth. And I wondered, when was the last time he and Alice had had a heart-to-heart? The jury was already seated, and at the bailiff's pronouncement, the room rose as the judge entered. The judge, the Honorable Howard Wells, was a short, tonsured man with a gleaming scalp and a gruff face. He had that rare panache that allowed a trial to proceed unencumbered by his personality, without allowing any doubt that we were in his room. Following the formalities of the court, the trial began. The prosecutor began the trial with an emotionally charged appeal in which he graphically described the horror of my alleged crime. From the winces on the jurors' faces, I believe he effectively made his point. It was the first time I had actually seen the prosecutor, and up to this point, he had been only a caricature, a title slapped on some hated adversarial force no less in my mind than an agent of evil. He was a thin man with sandy red hair and small wire-framed glasses. He wore a suit too large for his body, and it was not a far stretch to imagine him standing against the dugout fence as the other kids got picked first to play. I would be the first to admit that in another place and time, I probably would have liked the man. Confronting our adversaries is always an epiphanous experience. Amanda's opening statement was a well-stated counterpoint. She agreed with the prosecution that abuse by a caretaker was a heinous crime, certainly as heinous as child abuse, and that in the case of Henri McCord, it was exceptionally horrible. She then reminded the jury that what was on trial was not the horror of this crime, as that was a given, but the guilt of a young man in committing it. A young man with no previous history of criminal wrongdoing, assault, or even a speeding ticket. A young man who was not only an excellent employee at the facility, but an honor student who was recently awarded the University of Utah's prestigious presidential scholarship, and a son who lovingly took care of his mother as she died of cancer. Indignation, righteous or otherwise, is a weapon. We must be cautious in its handling, she said, for a weapon will kill the innocent just as dead as the guilty. At the conclusion of her remarks, the prosecution began to present their case against me, calling up a line of subpoenaed nurses and emergency room personnel who had attended to Henrietta's death. They were followed by an expert witness, a doctor who had clearly been well-rehearsed in his testimony. Their intent was to establish in the jurors' minds that Henri's death was caused by the beating and not a natural result of endless weeks of chronic asthmatic bronchitis. They displayed grisly color photographs of Henri's wounds, rendered all the more macabre by being attached to a corpse with an amputated limb. As the human body ages, the thin layer of fat tissue beneath the skin diminishes, rendering it far more susceptible to damage. A simple bump against a bed rail that would not leave a mark on a child may result in a massive bruise on a senior. The force of Alice's blows was sufficient to tear skin. The trial took a one-hour recess for lunch, and we ate at a cafeteria inside the facility to avoid the crowds that beset us both, as the mob had started in on Amanda as well. The afternoon testimony varied little from the morning's, and the congregation of onlookers sufficiently heated the room that the judge ordered the doors open to allow air circulation. The day's testimony ended unspectacularly, with one surprise. One of the prosecution's witnesses, a doctor, stunned the prosecution by stating that he doubted that the extent of the beating would have killed a man without severe bronchitis. The prosecution abruptly finished with the witness, and Amanda jumped on the chance to further establish the premise in the jurors' minds. Amanda had cross-examined each of the day's witnesses, but not with great intensity, often speaking from behind our table, as our defense strategy did not hinge on whether the beating had caused the death, as much as it did on my guilt for the action, though she still endeavored to cast doubt in the jurors' minds as to whether Henri would have survived the week even without such an assault. At the end of the day, Amanda and I stopped for aspirin and tacos before she dropped me off at home. At her advice, I kept the television off, made myself some tea, set the alarm, and crashed. Amanda picked me up at 7 the next morning, and this time we parked in the underground garage reserved for courtroom personnel, avoiding the throng that, enticed by the night's press coverage, had grown still larger than the day before. The day's proceedings began with the prosecution calling up another medical professional, better screened and rehearsed than their last, who basically reiterated the previous day's summations. Then the prosecutor again asserted the points they felt they had established. I began to understand their strategy, that repetition breeds consensus, and if you repeat the same accusations enough times, people will simply start believing them along with a host of other unproven recriminations. The prosecutor called Detective Kincaid as the next witness. Kincaid sauntered up to the witness box, slumping cavalierly in the chair. He wore a polyester jacket with a neatly pressed shirt and a knit tie.
"Detective, what is your position with the Ogden Police Department?"
"I am a homicide detective."
"How long have you been employed in that role?"
"I was transferred to homicide about 3 years ago, but I've been with the force about 8.
"You were assigned this case involving Henri McCord, is that correct?"
"Yes, sir."
"Please tell us the events that you were involved with in the early hours of January 7th.
He rubbed his mouth with his hand.
"Dispatch received a call from McKay Davis Hospital that an elderly man had been severely beaten and was in cardiac arrest."
"Did you go to the hospital and investigate?"
"Yes, sir."
"What did you find?"
"I found that Mr. McCord had been repeatedly bludgeoned. Marks indicated that he had been struck at least 16 times.
"Did you garner a statement from anyone at the hospital at that time?"
"I spoke to the doctors."
He pointed.
"Dr. Williams there, and a couple others."
"Did they corroborate that Mr. McCord had been assaulted?"
"Of course. It was obvious. Look at the pictures."
The prosecutor nodded.
"Was there a representative from the Arcadian nursing home present at that time?"
"Yes, Miss Richards had brought him."
"How was she acting?"
"She seemed real shaken up by the ordeal."
"What did she say to you?"
"I asked her if she had any idea about who might have done this, and she said that she had seen Mr. Kettington coming out of McCord's room around midnight, a couple hours after his shift had ended. She said she thought it strange because he was not assigned to the second-floor patients. She also said that he had acted strangely, had kind of a deer-in-the-headlights look about him."
I shook my head incredulously. Amanda put her hand on my knee to remind me to remain calm.
"In the course of your investigation, did you interview Mr. Kettington?"
on several occasions.
Did anything unusual transpire in those interviews?
He initially denied knowing who Henri McCord was, but when I pressed him, he claimed to suddenly remember.
Did he deny being with Mr. McCord the night of the assault?
No. In fact, he told me that he was there, but he didn't see anything.
When he learned of Henri's death, how did he respond?
Initially, he said that he was sorry.
Sorry?
The prosecutor interjected.
Sorry for what?
Well, I assume that he was just sorry that he died, I guess.
The prosecutor maundered toward the jurors.
When did Mr. Kennington learn that he was accused of assaulting Mr. McCord?
The morning that I brought him into the station.
What was his response at that time?
He wanted to know who had accused him.
What else happened that morning?
Kincaid looked at the prosecutor blankly. He had forgotten this part of the rehearsal. The prosecutor prompted him.
Before you picked up Mr. Kennington, did you visit the Arcadia?
Oh, right, he said. Yes, I did.
For what purpose?
We had been told by a witness, he glanced at Alice, Miss Richards, that she had seen Mr. Kennington stealing drugs, and she believed that they were still in his locker.
Did you find drugs in his locker?
Yes, we did. 3 bottles of Percocet. We also found individual capsules in his smock.
How did Mr. Kennington respond to that information about the drugs?
He denied that he used drugs.
After you drove Mr. Kennington to the station, did you interrogate him?
Yes, I did.
Did he say anything unusual in the interrogation?
He wanted to know who had accused him of stealing drugs.
What did you say?
I asked him why that was important to him. He seemed real interested in who had turned him in.
When did you decide to arrest him?
When he figured out that it was Miss Richards. For her safety, I thought that I had better incarcerate him.
The prosecutor stepped away.
Thank you, Detective.
Well, thank you, sir.
Cross?
The judge asked. Amanda looked up.
Yes, Your Honor.
She approached the officer.
Outside of Miss Richards' testimony, did you interview anyone else at the Arcadia?
Yes, ma'am.
Did any of them accuse Michael as well?
No.
Did any of them suspect Michael?
No.
Did anyone else see Michael leaving Henri McCord's room?
No.
Did anyone else at the Arcadia suspect Michael of stealing or using drugs?
Not to my knowledge.
The warrant you received to search Michael's locker was based solely on the testimony of Miss Richards.
Yes.
So you are telling us that the whole of your suspicion is based solely on the testimony of one person, Alice Richards?
Yes, well, that and my interviews with Kennington.
Do you suspect that, based on the witness's testimony, you were biased toward Mr. Kennington before you interviewed him?
It would be kind of hard not to be.
You have made it sound as if Michael Kennington acted suspiciously and wanted to know who had accused him. If you were falsely accused of a crime, would you personally have any interest in who had accused you?
I object, Your Honor, the prosecutor said. The witness's hypothetical actions in this regard are irrelevant.
Sustained.
Your Honor, I am attempting to establish that my client's actions are not unusual and certainly not grounds for suspicion.
Move on, Counselor.
Amanda looked flustered.
Of course you would, she said to Kincaid.
The prosecutor threw his hands up dramatically.
Your Honor!
That will be enough of that, Counselor, the judge said forcefully. Strike Mrs. Epperson's remark from the record.
I apologize, Your Honor,
she said contritely. She turned back to Kincaid.
When you found the drugs in Mr. Kennington's smock, did you look in there yourself, or did someone else suggest that you look there?
Kincaid looked stumped.
I don't remember, ma'am.
Amanda stepped away.
No further questions.
The prosecution conferred among themselves for a moment. Then, as Amanda had predicted, I was called to the stand. As I sat down, I looked over the gallery, and from the vantage of the witness box, I saw something that I did not expect. At first, I did not believe what I saw. 6 rows back, near the center of the gallery, sat Faye. I had not seen her right off, as she was sandwiched between 2 large men and looked exceptionally small. Her hair was styled differently, and as I looked closely to verify that it was she, we shared eye contact. Her eyes were not distant, and she reached up and touched her lips. And despite everything I had heard or hadn't, I knew somehow that she was with me. Just her being there was proof of that, and it gave me strength. The prosecutor approached me. his chin raised in a confident air.
"Mr. Kettington, do you know Alice Richards?"
I looked over at Alice, who sat listlessly, gazing on the proceedings with dispassionate eyes. "Yes, I worked with her."
"What else do you know about Alice?"
"She's the woman who accused me of beating Henri."
"When did you know that it was she who had testified against you to the police?"
"When I was arrested. The police officer told me that it was she."
"When you were released from jail, did you go to see Alice?"
I glanced over at Amanda, who looked dismayed by the question.
"No, I went to the Arcadia to see a friend, and Alice was there."
"Did you speak to her?"
"Yes."
"Did you tell her, and I quote, that she should not be speaking to anyone and should just keep her damn mouth shut?"
Amanda looked mortified. At the time, it had seemed natural and inconsequential, and I suddenly thought that I probably should have told her about the incident.
"Yes, I did."
There was an audible gasp from the gallery.
"Do you realize that that exchange constitutes witness tampering, a third-degree felony?"
"I just lost my temper," I said stupidly.
"Ye lost your temper," the prosecutor repeated, as if he liked the remark. "That's not a good excuse for breaking the law, Mr. Kettington. The same way you lost your temper the day you struck Henri McCord."
"I object, Your Honor,"
Amanda said, rising.
"It has not been established that my client struck Henri McCord."
"Sustained, Counselor."
Al rephrased the question.
"Did you lose your temper and strike Henri McCord?"
"I have never struck any of the patients in the Arcadia. I couldn't do that."
"Do you use drugs, Mr. Kettington?"
"No, sir. I have never used drugs before."
"How do you explain the 3 bottles of Percocet that were found in your locker at the Arcadia, as well as the pills in the pocket of your smock?"
"They were not put there by me."
"Then how did they get there?"
"I don't know. Alice was in charge of the prescriptions."
"Are you saying that Alice Richards put them there?"
"I really can't say."
The prosecutor nodded his head, then turned and took a few steps toward the jury box, as if he had just proven some point vital to his case.
"Your father was an alcoholic, was he not?"
Amanda quickly rose.
"I object, Your Honor. The witness's father's actions are not relevant to this inquiry."
The prosecutor smiled confidently.
"Your Honor, it has been demonstrated that the cycle of physical abuse is an act that is often perpetrated and carried down in families. As this is a case involving severe physical abuse, I find it very relevant."
The judge said,
"I will allow it, only so far as to establish some reasonable act of familial abuse."
"Thank you, Your Honor."
He turned back to me.
"Your father was an alcoholic?"
"Yes."
"So there was alcohol in the home?"
"Sometimes."
"He drank every day?"
"Yes."
"And there was only alcohol sometimes?"
"My mother didn't allow it in the home. She would dump it out or hide it when he fell asleep. So my father only brought in the bottle he was drinking."
"Did your father ever beat you?"
"No."
"Did he ever beat your mother?"
"No."
"He never beat your mother when she poured out his alcohol?"
"I saw him push my mother up against a wall once."
"And that was it?"
"He stopped when he saw me. He wasn't a violent man."
The prosecutor rubbed his chin.
"I don't know if I find it more disturbing or revealing that you confess that your father threw your mother against a wall, but he was not a violent man. What is your definition of violence?"
"I would consider that act violent," I stammered. "What I meant was, not usually. He was more likely to fall asleep or cry when he drank."
"Is it possible that your father beat your mother outside of your view?"
Amanda interjected.
"I object, Your Honor. How could the witness answer that question?"
"Withdraw your question, Counselor."
"How did your mother act after a night of your father being home drunk?"
"Hurt. She was a good woman. She didn't deserve to be treated like that. No one deserves to be treated like that."
"She would be ashamed to learn of these proceedings, would she not?"
"She would be afraid. She spent much of her life afraid. But she would have nothing to be ashamed of."
He smiled cynically.
"In the past 2 years, you have dropped out of school and left a job under pressure of being fired. The Arcadia was the first job you have been able to hold in some time, that is, before you were given a restraining order, was it not?"
Yes, but that's because I was taking care of my mother.
That's all, Mr. Keddington.
The prosecutor turned to Amanda.
You're a witness, Counselor.
The defense does not wish to cross-examine at this time, Your Honor.
You may be seated,
the judge said to me.
I rose from the box and returned to my seat. I looked up at Fay once before I sat down, then glanced toward the jury box. Not a single juror looked toward me. Somewhere I had heard that that was a bad sign. The prosecution resumed.
I would like to call to the stand Miss Alice Richards.
Alice rose and walked to the front of the room. She avoided eye contact with me, only glancing at me briefly.
Miss Richards, how long have you worked at the Arcadia Care Facility?
It will be 3 years this July.
During that time, were there ever any reported incidents of patient abuse?
Not to my knowledge, no.
You were at work on the night of January 6th?
Yes.
Please tell the jury what happened that night.
I was working the night shift. A few hours into my shift, I went in to check on Henri. He had been on our watch list because he had acute bronchitis and wasn't improving. When I came into his room, he was comatose.
You are sufficiently qualified to make that assessment. I mean, you knew that he wasn't just asleep?
I am an RN, so I have medical training. Henri didn't look right. His breathing was so shallow that it was almost imperceptible. I felt his forehead, and it was very hot.
What did you do then?
I called the paramedics, and they rushed him to the hospital.
At that time, did you suspect that any abuse had taken place?
No. He had been very sick for several months.
When did you learn that Henri had been beaten?
When the ER doctors removed his shirt. He had severe bruises all over his body.
She pointed at the previous exhibit.
Like those pictures. It looked to me like he had been repeatedly struck by something. In fact, some of the wounds were still bleeding.
What was your first thought?
I didn't know what to think. Then I remembered hearing a strange noise and seeing Michael come out of his room. I thought it peculiar because Michael's shift ended several hours earlier.
Did you tell the attendant medical personnel that you suspected him?
Yes, I did.
Then what happened?
Henri went into cardiac arrest. He died right after that.
Are you aware that Mr. Keddington has accused you of abusing Henri?
Yes.
What do you have to say to that?
I think Michael is afraid.
I object, Your Honor. Conjecture on the part of the witness is irrelevant. Sustained. Strike the witness's remark from the record.
The prosecutor continued.
Is it true that Mr. Keddington entered your nursing home on the night of January 20th, roughly 10 days after he was released from his responsibilities?
Yes, he did.
What was the purpose of his visit?
I don't know.
Did you see him enter the Arcadia?
Yes. He came straight to me.
Did he speak to you?
Yes.
What exactly did he say?
He told me not to talk to anybody. Then he told me to keep my damn mouth shut.
Did he threaten you?
From someone who had beaten an elderly man, I took that as a threat.
The prosecutor stepped back and looked toward the jury and nodded his head as if to punctuate the remark. He slowly turned back toward Alice.
There were pills found in Mr. Keddington's locker. Do you know what they were?
They were bottles of Percocet that belonged to some of the patients. Percocet is a painkiller.
What were they doing in Mr. Keddington's locker?
I could only speculate. They belonged to the patients.
Are you in charge of prescriptions at the Arcadia?
Yes.
Were you aware that those pills were missing?
Not those, specifically. There are so many medications that I'm not always good about throwing out old pills. Though I did notice recently that things seemed to be disappearing, and on several occasions I had to reorder some prescriptions.
Do you remember about when it was that these medications started to mysteriously vanish?
Around the beginning of November.
And what was significant about that time?
It was around the time Michael came to work at the Arcadia.
The prosecutor paused again for emphasis, and I looked up at the jury, and two of the jurors quickly looked away.
Did you suspect Mr. Keddington of stealing the drugs?
She turned and looked at me.
No. I thought he was a decent guy.
Did you suspect him of physical abuse?
No, I didn't. He acted decent enough. In fact, some of the residents are his friends.
Do you consider Michael Keddington capable of abusing a patient?
Objection, Your Honor. This calls for conjecture.
Your Honor, we are seeking to validate the character of a fellow employee. As a character witness, conjecture is relevant.
The judge did not answer immediately.
I'll allow it.
Again, Miss Richards, do you consider Michael Keddington capable of abusing a patient? She furtively glanced at me.
I don't know. I think he has had a rough time in life and needs some help.
No further questions, Miss Richards. He stepped back to his seat and looked once at the jury, then the judge.
Your Honor, the prosecution rests.
The judge surveyed the room.
Would the defense care to cross-examine the witness?
Amanda rose.
Not at this time, Your Honor.
The judge glanced up to the courtroom clock, then reiterated his warning from the previous day.
It is nearly 5 o'clock. I adjourn this trial until tomorrow morning. I counsel the jurors to not watch television news or read anything concerning this trial and to avoid forming any opinions until we have heard from the defense. You are not to speak to anyone concerning this trial, including witnesses and legal counsel. If you are approached by someone who wishes to speak to you concerning this trial, you are required to report that individual to this court.
He pounded his gavel.
This court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
Chapter 27. A Last Goodbye.
There are those whose primary ambition in life is to leave their names chiseled on some small corner of this globe. But this is folly. The greatest tragedy is not to die unknown by strangers, but unloved by our companions.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. At the judge's adjournment, the noise in the courtroom rose in an excited cacophony. I turned around to look for Faye. She was making her way against the exiting crowd toward me. Her countenance was grave, and she looked wan. She stepped in front of me, and we looked at each other like strangers, unsure of each other's hearts. I could then see that her eyes were moist, and she came close and lifted her arms around me. I held her tightly. Just then a woman in silver bifocals and tall permed hair reminiscent of a beehive walked up next to me, her face contorted with hatred.
I hope you rot in hell for what you've done.
I could feel Faye tense, and she moved to turn back toward the woman, but I held her.
Let her go, Faye.
Her jaw clenched.
How can you do that?
It won't help me.
She fell back into me, burying her face into my shoulder. Amanda turned and said to me,
Michael, I need to talk to you.
She looked at the woman pressed against me.
Is this Faye?
Faye looked up, then instinctively glanced down at Amanda's stomach.
I'm Faye.
She held out her hand.
I'm glad you came,
Amanda said.
You two would probably like to be together.
Faye looked at me.
My parents don't know I'm here.
There's room at my place, I said. Amanda touched my arm.
Let's get out of here. We can cover tomorrow's agenda on the way home.
The three of us stopped for dinner at a Japanese restaurant, and it seemed that Amanda did most of the talking as Faye retreated slightly into herself. My stomach hurt, and I drank a bowl of miso soup. Amanda dropped us off at the house around 8, and I let Faye in, and she flung a leather-bottomed backpack from her shoulder and fell back into the couch.
Let's talk, she said.
I sat down across from her, my fingers pensively knit together. Faye sighed.
I am sorry that I have left you alone through all this. I have been so confused. My father told me about taking you to dinner. He thought you were past tense to me, so he felt free to tell me about his threat. I'm sorry, Michael. I was so hurt when I left, but you thought you were protecting me.
She paused.
I decided to wait a month, just to clear out my head, but it became clear every day how much I love you and want you.
her forehead wrinkled with anxiety.
"Then all this happened. My father faxed the article to me, then told me that you had confessed to beating the old man to death."
I was suddenly angry, as much at Faye as her father.
"And you believed him?"
She began to tear up.
"No, I didn't."
The room fell quiet, and Faye came over and sat down next to me. She put her arms around my neck, then gently pulled me into her, maternally pressing my head into her breast. We lay there silently, and I could hear Faye's heart pounding. Finally, Faye spoke.
"Amanda made it sound like this might end tomorrow."
"It could. I come home free, or will not see this place for years. Maybe you, too." She pulled back to look into my face.
"No, Michael. I won't desert you again."
Her promise did not raise my spirits. "What if I'm found guilty?"
"I will stay with you as long as they let me. I don't know if they'll just take you away or what. We'll see, I guess. I won't desert you, Michael," she repeated.
"What if I'm found not guilty?" She thought about it.
"I'll fly back to school. I have an exam Monday, but it's spring break the week after next, and we'll spend every minute of it together."
I sighed. I can't believe that this time tomorrow night I could be in prison. Faye's eyes moistened.
"Ask for a commitment, Michael. Let me prove my love to you. Please give me the chance."
I looked at her, and my eyes also moistened. But I would not do it. It would be like exacting a deathbed promise. It would not be right. So I just lay back into her, and she pulled me tightly against her again and kissed me. Then she just held me lovingly, and it was the best thing I have ever felt. A half hour later, just before 11, the phone rang. I debated answering it, then, deciding it might be Amanda, lifted the receiver. A feeble voice came from the receiver.
"Michael?"
It was Esther. I was surprised at the deterioration of her speech since the day before.
"Did Faye come?"
she asked. The words came driven and desperate, as if she were unable to stop them. Still, they were tinged with reticence and fear for the answer.
"She's here with me now."
There was silence on the other end, and I could imagine her praying in gratitude.
"I knew she would."
"Are you all right?"
Her voice was soft.
"I'm just so tired, Michael. I'm not doing too well. You'll come see me when this is over?"
"First thing."
"Michael."
She paused for the longest time, until I wondered if she had perhaps fallen off to sleep.
"I wanted to tell you that I love you."
As trite as those words may seem, I am still astonished at their power from the right mouths and at the right times. "I love you too, Esther." I could hear the receiver fumble around in its cradle before it went dead. Chapter 28. Esther's Letter.
"Oftentimes the difference between a lynch mob and a square dance is a good fiddler."
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. Utah's climate is as diverse as its landscape, from the perennially baked red rock tabernacles of southern Utah to the snow-capped mountains to the north, where March enters like a lion and is just as likely to go out as one. That night, the snow came again, and although I hoped that the inclement weather might lessen the crowds at the trial, the night's media again added to the assembly, and were tickets sold to such events, I would have expected scalpers out in the storm hawking the better seats. I suspect that they smelled blood. The night with Fay had, in some ways, left me more fearful of the day, as it was a powerful reminder of just how vacant I felt without her. And I knew it was possible that a verdict could be handed down by late afternoon, forcing our separation.
"There are going to be a few surprises today," Amanda said nebulously as the three of us drove to the courthouse.
"What kind of surprises?" She seemed suddenly grave.
"There's a few that for the time being I would prefer to remain such. One you need to know about is that I'm going to call you up first to testify. I want you to tell the jury what happened that night, about the sound you heard and about finding Alice in the room. But let me caution you. Whatever you do, don't make it sound like you're accusing Alice. We can't prove Alice did anything, and the prosecution would have a heyday vilifying you. I just want to plant seeds of doubt. I will also ask you if you beat Henri McCord. You think it will make a difference? I want the jury to hear it from you. You're a very genuine and sincere man. I would like to have them see that before I call my other witnesses. I think it will especially appeal to a couple of the mothers in the jury."
Fay took my hand. "Do you think the prosecution will cross-examine me?"
"Hard to say. Probably not if we don't give them anything they can actually dispute. They've already hit you with their best shot, and they don't want to end with something less potent. If you don't make any accusations that we can't stand behind, they should pass."
"You mean accusing Alice?"
"Exactly." Her countenance lightened. "Nervous?"
"I think I'm digesting my stomach lining."
"I think it will be a good day,"
she said casually, as if she had forgotten that my next 15 years depended upon it. About a half hour into the morning's proceedings, I was called back into the witness box. The bailiff reminded me that I was still under oath. Then Amanda approached, waddling maternally, and I wondered if it was exaggerated for the jury. She wore a maternity blouse and stretch pants that highlighted her condition, and after watching her in action for 2 days, I did not think it a coincidence. Amanda left little to chance, and I now thought it fortunate that she was pregnant, as she had clearly aligned herself with me, and no one wants to see a pregnant woman lose.
"Good morning, Michael,"
she said with the pleasant tonality of a neighbor's greeting. I instinctively smiled, which I suspect she had hoped for.
"Did you like working at the Arcadia Care Center?"
"It took a little while to get used to some of it, but once I knew the people, it was a great job."
"On the night of January 6th, the night of Henri McCord's beating, you had clocked out at 9 o'clock, but you did not leave work until after midnight. Why were you there so late?"
"A friend of mine, one of the residents, wasn't doing too well. She had taken to bed, and I was hoping that I could cheer her up."
"What time did you leave?"
"I don't know the exact time, but I arrived home around 12:30, so it was probably a little after midnight."
"What floor were you on with your friend?"
"I was on the 3rd floor.
"As you were leaving that night, did anything unusual happen?"
"I heard a strange noise coming from the 2nd floor. I stopped to investigate and found that it was coming from Henri's room. But when I checked, all I found was Alice standing next to his bed."
"What was she doing?"
"Just standing there. She said she was trying to give him his medicine."
"Was she holding his medicine?"
"No, she had one hand on his crutch. I assumed that she had given up trying to get him to take it."
"What kind of noise did you hear?"
"It was a kind of yelp. My first thought was that there was an animal on the floor." She paused as if she herself were considering the revelation for the first time.
"Michael, did you like Henri McCord?"
"I didn't know him well, but I suspected that he was lonely, being so old and the only black man in the home. I felt sorry for him. I suppose I liked him."
"Michael, did you beat Henri McCord?"
"No, ma'am. I was hired to take care of him." Amanda stared at me with kindness.
"Thank you, Michael. That is all, Your Honor."
Before she could return, the prosecutor stood. He looked excited,
as if he had suddenly stumbled upon something.
"Mr. Keddington, what is your disposition toward blacks?"
"My disposition is favorable."
"Have you ever participated in an anti-affirmative action demonstration?"
"No, sir."
"Do you dislike blacks?"
"Of course not," I said curtly. "That would be like disliking elderly people because they are old." Amanda smiled, and the prosecutor turned away, frustrated that the trail led nowhere.
"That's all. You may be seated, Mr. Keddington," the judge said.
Amanda winked at me as I stepped from the box and she stood.
"The defense would like to call to the stand Ms. Helen Staples."
This was one of Amanda's surprises, as I considered Helen a more likely witness for the prosecution than us. Helen walked up to the witness stand. She wore her smock from the nursing home.
"Ms. Staples, what is your position at the Arcadia Care Facility?"
"I am the director of the facility."
"How long have you been employed in that position?"
"Nearly 8 years."
"You are the one responsible for hiring Michael Keddington, is that correct?"
She looked at me.
"Yes, I am."
"What kind of an employee was Michael Keddington?"
"He was a very conscientious one. He worked hard."
"In your opinion, would Michael have beaten a patient?"
"No, he would not."
"You sound relatively certain of that."
"I watch my employees very carefully, usually when they don't know that they are being watched. I have seen how he treats the patients. He treats them with dignity. It's something you either have or don't. A person who would beat a patient would not be very likely to spend his off hours at the facility visiting them."
Amanda moved toward the middle of the floor.
"Your Honor, Ms. Staples has brought with her today a letter from one of the Arcadia's residents, which I would like to read in Michael's behalf."
The prosecutor stood.
"I object, Your Honor. This is not relevant character evidence."
"Your Honor,"
Amanda countered,
"this letter constitutes grounds of pertinent character trait."
"Overruled."
The prosecutor persisted.
"Your Honor, this letter is inadmissible on grounds of hearsay."
"The defense cites hearsay exception rule 804, as the declarant is physically unable to attend court,"
Amanda said.
"Why is this witness unavailable, Counselor?"
Amanda was suddenly hesitant, and as she looked back at me, I felt the uneasiness of her gaze.
"The woman who wrote this letter died early this morning."
The words took my breath away. I gaped at Amanda, then glanced over to Helen, who looked on dolefully as if to affirm Amanda's statement. My eyes watered, and I dropped my head in my hands, then moved them over my eyes. The judge patiently observed the interaction, then said,
"Hearsay objection overruled."
Amanda opened the letter.
"This letter is dated March 24th, 3 days ago."
She cleared her throat.
"Dear jurors, my name is Esther Hewish. I have spent the last 7 years as a resident of the Arcadia Care Facility. I have been, by my own preference, alone for most of that time. That is, until last fall, when I met Michael Keddington. Despite my obstinance, Michael's acts of kindness eventually opened my heart to him. He would often visit me after work, and he would keep me company. He is loved not just by me, but also by all the residents that know him. I have collected their signatures of support in his behalf. Michael has been accused of beating a fellow resident, Henri McCord. We hope for the speedy and severe prosecution of the person guilty of this great evil, for hurting one of our fellows. But we are certain that it was not Michael who committed this atrocity, and fear that the true culprit might be allowed free. The harsh life Michael has lived has softened his spirit, not calloused it. Any society that destroys such spirits must reap what it deserves, bitter, angry sons resigned to a world that is as merciless as it is unjust. If my son had grown to be a man, I would hope he would have been like Michael. Sincerely, M. Esther Hewish. We, the undersigned,